Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I am rebroadcasting part of an interview I did with Bob Tresolini, actor, director, writer, choreographer, dancer, entertainer, extraordinaire. Last year, I interviewed Bob when he was directing a production of Seussical the Musical. And at that time, he told me that he really likes working with kids. And it's a good thing, because this year, he's directing Annie. And so I'm rebroadcasting the early part of the interview, where he talks about his early life and his career, which is quite fascinating. And then he talks about this production of Annie, what it's like to work with kids, and what it's like to direct this show, which is one of the few he hasn't gotten a chance to direct yet. So hang on. Here come the show.
An inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
All about finding yourself and then being yourself. And perhaps you know that that is easier said than done. We are so bombarded in this culture with ideas, well, probably in all cultures, but this is the one I know best, with ideas about who we ought to be and who we ought not to be. I talk every week, about the powerful, profound, irresistible impact of our family of origin on who it is we think we could and couldn't, should and shouldn't be. But the culture also provides a powerful, continuing litany of lessons and messages about what we should and shouldn't do, who we should and shouldn't be, what is good, what is bad. And I have lived long enough to see some of these things disproven. When I was a kid, women were instructed to do the 100, maybe it was 1,000, I don't actually remember because I never did it, hair stroking of the brush of the hair every night. Well, it turns out that's a dreadful thing. I need hardly tell any of you who have been alive more than 10 years that the ideas about what we should and shouldn't eat and what's good for us and what's not good for us, I still don't know whether eggs do or don't make cholesterol worse. Every 10 minutes, it seems to me, a different authority is saying something else about it. But what is consistent is that whatever it is that they're telling us it's the thing. There's no gray. There's never any gray. And we are encouraged from the very beginning to believe that there is a right and a wrong way, and discouraged from asking ourselves, what's my way? What is the way that works for me? It's very, very difficult to hold on to that idea that there's a way that works for me, especially if the way that works for you is not the way that works for the large number of people or the people who matter to you or what they tell you. If you are somehow different, you hear a different drummer. And I actually believe that if we all listened to ourselves, we would be hearing a lot of different drummers. That there is not just one-size-fits-all solution to problems or ways to be. There are person-specific ways to be. And so the intention of the Lynn Show and of all the work that I do as a psychotherapist is to help everybody who listens to the show and everybody who calls me on the phone for psychotherapy to find their person-specific way. One of the ways that I try and make this point is by playing interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because when you listen to someone who has dedicated their life to an art, you can hear that this is who they really are. And today's interview is no exception. In fact, he might be the poster child for being who he really is. Bob Drissolini learned early that he had the capacity to entertain, that he had a lot of talent, and that people wanted to watch him and laugh at him and enjoy his antics. But he also understood quite clearly that theater, which is where his talents would most likely wind up, is not really a good way to make a living in this culture. So he created a life that was particularly the Bob life. He took what he was and found a place to put it. And now, in what we might laughingly call his retirement, he is still using those amazing talents, all of them, the acting, the singing, the dancing, the choreographing, the directing, the writing, to entertain. Currently, he is entertaining in Sarasota, Florida. And as you will hear, he's currently directing a production of the musical Annie for the Players Theater. So I'm going to play a song from the original cast album of Annie, the one everyone knows, Tomorrow. And following that is going to be my interview with Bob Drissolini.
The sun will come out tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun. Just thinking about tomorrow clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow till there's none. When I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin and grin and say, oh, the sun will come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow, come what may. Tomorrow, tomorrow, I love ya. Tomorrow, you're always a day away.
I'm here with Bob Drissolini in his stunning apartment. It's beautiful.
Yeah, look, overlooking the Gulf of Mexico.
No,
it's beautiful.
No kidding. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Mm-hmm.
And it's screamingly apparent that you make your life definitely
with the art of theater, with the art of performance. Mm-hmm. This is correct, right?
Yes, and I did it all my life because in when I was working for corporate America, I was always the promotion person. So I would plan the sales meetings, the conventions. I would plan. My first and earliest one was I worked for Good Humor Ice Cream. I was a good humor man, as they would say. I was on the stick, as they used to say. But what I did for Good Humor was, and they were part of Thomas J. Lipton Tea, so mm-hmm. it was a big corporate company.
Yeah, yeah.
I would go out in the spring, and it would take me all year to do this, and I would do what they used to say, the kickoff for the season, and I would get all of the sales managers and the drivers together at a hotel, and we'd put on a skit of what it was like to sell to kids, uh-huh. and we would do musical numbers, and we would get them all hepped up to go out and sell for the season.
Yeah.
So that's how I started.
And it was theater.
Oh, it was theater all the way. It was theater all the way. And then I would be involved, and I was on television. I was the Good Humor Man on the Sonny Fox Show on Wonderama, and I would do ice cream making contests, and I would have the hat, and I would have the whistle, and I'd get the kids lined up, and they would have to, they get so many minutes to run down the, and then scoop it, and add how many things, and it was the ice cream making contest.
You were the first reality show.
Yeah, and that was many years ago.
Well, okay, so what I always ask is, where did this start? How was there a moment in your childhood?
Yes.
When that you said, I want to be on stage, I like to perform, yep. I'm interested. Yeah, what?
My cousin, who has deceased now, and I loved her to death, her name was Pat Shaw, and she was the kind of kid, she was about 5 years older than me, and she would always organize kids to put on shows. So whenever we had a family gathering, you know, there was my brother and I and my cousin Pat, and she would put this skit together, and where we lived, that we had this curtain in between our living room and the dining room, and everybody would sit in the living room, and we'd get behind the curtain, and then she'd have it ripped open, and out we'd come, and my big number was, be a clown, and it would end up where they would put me on my head, you know, I'd get on my, do a headstand, and they would hold my leg, and they'd let me go, and I'd fall. And I was probably no more than, I don't know, 5, 6 maybe at that point. And I just said, oh, this is terrific. So I went to dancing school. And
oh, yeah, you know, take me through it slowly.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you enjoyed the performance, you enjoyed the you enjoyed the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So you said, I want to go to dancing school? Or
my mother was a dancer. She was an Irish stepper.
Ah.
And they decided they'd put me into dancing school. And
not your brother?
No. He was just the opposite of me.
Okay, so he indulged Pat and you in the show, but he didn't really get off on it.
He wound up becoming a priest. Totally the opposite of me.
They really did get the opposite ends of the continuum here.
The yin and yang.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So, your mother said, oh, you seem to be enjoying this. Why don't we put you in dance school?
Yeah.
And so how old were you?
5, 6.
So we're talking tap, we're talking
ballet. Oh, yeah, tap and jazz.
Tap and jazz,
and right. I did that. And then all through school, you know, whenever there was a school play or something like that, I was the lead in the high school graduating show. You know, it's always the big thing.
What was the show, Dan?
Best Foot Forward.
Mm.
The Best Foot Forward. And they made that into a musical. Didn't that go into being Good News or one of those? The Best Foot Forward? That was straight play, and then I think it became a musical. I think it was Good News.
So you did it as a straight play?
Yeah, The Best Foot Forward. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were doing straight also, not just musical,
Then, I went to college at night, and I got my degree. But at the same time, I worked with a lady called Kay Monahan, and her partner was a guy named Freddie Sleckman. And he used to have a nightclub act on a ship called the Mandalay in the New York Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to work for RKO. And their big thing, and it was a terrific organization that they had, they would go to a Knights of Columbus, a Temple, a Kiwanis, a Lions Club, and they would get all their members, and they would do one rehearsal. They would do a rehearsal a week for 8 weeks, and then they would put on a big variety show, and it was a fundraiser for that organization.
Oh, great.
So I wound up rehearsing with firemen. We did the Garfield Fire Department. and we would rehearse in the firehouse. We did the Knights of Columbus. We did two or three different temples. We did a couple of churches. And all this was always for them. And so what we would do is we would do these great big production numbers. And every number, this is fun, every show would be the men in drag.
Are you kidding?
No. And all the wives used to go hysterical.
Oh, yeah, loved it.
Yeah.
Right. So who wrote this stuff?
I did, and Kay. We used to put the stuff together.
So now, was it designed for the firemen? And
yep.
The, yeah. Yeah, so you, wow. Yep.
And we would take different numbers, and we would reuse them, like the one that they used to love, the men used to love to do. They'd all dress up in their wives' house dresses, and they'd have big balloons on, and they'd have these crazy wigs. And they would sing Powder Your Face with Sunshine, and they'd go out into the audience with big powder puffs and powder people. I mean, it was that kind of thing.
Milton Berle.
Exactly. Milton Berle. It was outrageous, crazy, but they always had one number in the show was a drag number. And everybody waited for it, because what would it be this year?
Yeah.
It was always something
different.
So you were
famous for it.
Right. And then we would do, like, big things, like we would do a gypsy number. So we would do this thing with a campfire, and we would sing Golden Earrings, and then we would do the Hungarian dance, and, you know, we'd do a Western theme, you know, they'd sing a ballad, and then we'd do a hoedown. And,
this is not unlike Pat's, you know, the stuff you were doing when you were a kid.
Do you know when I did God a Minute here? Do you remember the cancer
fair?
Well, that was very much like what we did. We did all these skits and numbers and production numbers and throw this mulligan stew together, as we would call it.
Right.
And it would come out as a big variety show.
Right.
And so when Jeffrey said to me here, Jeffrey King, I'm jumping, aren't I?
Yeah, no, it's okay. He's going to take you back.
He said, his mother was diagnosed with cancer and he had to do something. And it was like, Jeffrey and I have been friends for 21 years. And it was like Mickey and Judy. Well, let's put on a show. And that's how God a Minute got started. And with all these crazy things we
But again, this is your early training with Pat and your brother.
Yeah.
It was this,
yep.
You know, and you've been doing this since you were five.
Yep.
So essentially you're the person, you're the guy who knows how to do this, right?
And then I took that into.
Wait! I want to stop you.
Okay.
Because I don't want to miss anything. So you said you sort of threw it away. I went to college at night and I got my degree. What did you get your degree in?
Marketing.
Ah, how interesting! Not theater.
No, I got my degree in marketing because I knew that, you know, you can always do some theater, but you want to be paid.
Uh-huh.
So what I wound up doing is, and this is what really. Where I made my money over the years, I wound up working for not only Lipton, then from Lipton I was hired at a very early age to go into an agency in New York City, Elliot J. Axelrod Associates on Madison Avenue. And I went in as an account supervisor on Taylor Wine. And just at that time, they were getting purchased by Coca-Cola.
Ooh.
So that's when they had Taylor California Cellars, and they wound up getting Sterling and Monterey were the two other wines that went with it. And I wound up going all around the country introducing the Taylor Wine Company into the Coca-Cola business. So the big show that I did is I went down to Atlanta and we did a kickoff meeting. And literally a kickoff meeting. We took the Peachtree Plaza ballroom and turned it into a football stadium. I had the Coca-Cola Drum and Bugle Championship Corps. I had the Atlanta Falcon cheerleaders. Everybody was dressed as football players. And everybody, to go into the ballroom, the way we did it, they went up the escalator, just like you were going to go into a stadium. But then we had tunnels that led into, and when they came out, they were in bleachers and press boxes, and, you know, it had the big 30, 40-foot ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it had the feeling of a stadium, and we had the entire ballroom covered in AstroTurf with the yard lines, and in the middle was the Taylor wine leaf as the, you know, in the 50-yard line. And we actually did a football rally. I had cheerleaders, I had a marching band, and all of the floats that we brought out were the different displays that were going to be that year. And I was the radio announcer. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Coca-Cola Stadium. And it was just terrific.
It's perfect.
Yeah. And
it's
so
perfect. And you had all this money to use.
Yep.
You could do whatever you wanted.
Oh, I mean, I would go in and they'd give me a million-dollar budget to put in.
Yeah, right. I can hear it. Wow.
And when people walked in, all of the executives were in football garb throwing ball like they were warming up. So this was like a practice going on as all of the attendees. And I had like 1,000 people attend this. Had 500 on each side of the Think of a stadium, 500 on each side.
Holy cow.
Yeah, yeah. They came in from all over the world because this was a big deal. This was a big launch of purchasing this company. And if you remember when Tale of California Sellers came out, that was a big thing. It was all over. End dial displays and all that kind of stuff. So that's what started to happen. I started to work. Then I got involved. Do you remember the Millikan Breakfast Show at the Waldorf Astoria? Millikan Mills?
No, I don't.
Out of the Carolinas? Well, that's where I really started to get involved with Broadway things. Because what they would do is they would take the cast of various Broadway shows. As a matter of fact, Chorus Line was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we would rewrite it, and we would sing One Singular Fabric, Every Little Stitch We Make. And we would, and the entire cast had Donna McKechnie and all the kids come out and do in their roles, and sing about Millikan. And we had Hamarni Gingell, we had Angela Lansbury,
we had
Bobby Morse, we had the cast of Chorus Line, Phyllis Diller was on Broadway. Whoever was appearing on Broadway that season would get it. The kids would love to do the show because they got paid more money to do
one breakfast show than they got
the entire week.
I'm sure.
Broadway.
Right.
Yeah, they were getting like $900,000 a pop.
Oh, my God.
And they would do one every day. Because it would go into the main ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria for a week.
Wow.
And then it was so successful that the following year they would do a breakfast show and a cocktail show. So they would do a show in the morning.
Right.
And then they would do a show right after work. So these kids would really be
rigging it in. Right.
They would do a breakfast show.
Then they'd go to the theater.
Then they would do a cocktail show. Then they go to the theater. And then on the Wednesdays, they would do a breakfast show, a Wednesday matinee, a Wednesday cocktail. But
They didn't care. They were
packing the money in.
Right. And you were still doing the same thing. This is like you were born to do this.
Yeah. And then I wound up, I was with the agency, and then the owner of the agency, then they made me a vice president. And then I became a junior partner, and I invested some money into it. And then they sold the agency to an agency in Chicago who was after the Planters Peanuts business, which was one of our clients at the agency.
So that's why they bought it, because they wanted Planters Peanuts?
They wanted that. And they wanted me to go out and relocate to Chicago, and there was no way I was going to go out to Chicago. No way. Because I was a New York boy, you know, I was New Jersey, and that was it. I was not going to go to Chicago. And everything was happening so fast, and I had two wonderful clients. One of them was KLM Royal Dutch Airlines, and the other one was Bacardi Rum. And both of them, you know, I was close enough to them to really, you know, say, I'm going to probably have to leave because I just can't do this. And I said, well, we're not going to stay if you're not staying. Because I was their account person.
Right.
And they said, have you thought about opening up your own? And I said, hey, that's a good idea. And they said, well, if you do, we'll back you. And so I did. The creative director of the agency and myself were both junior partners. We both felt it wasn't in our best interest. And we said, you know, let's open our own. And we did. And our two clients was KLM and Bacardi. You can believe that? And from there, it just... The people that really wanted Planters Peanuts, which was part of Nabisco went with us.
Oh, God!
So that whole thing fell apart, and I wound up having my own business. And it was called the West Bank Creative. And people say, why did you call that? Because it was on the West Bank of the Hudson River. And a lot of people thought we were a Jewish organization. You know something? Yeah.
So I
used to jokingly say, no, but some of my best friends are. But we had a great time, and so for 23 years, I ran that, and then Bob at the time was working for Hoffman LaRoche, and they decided at one point that anybody over 40, they were going to dump, and 2,200 people were let go. That was the first Class A action thing that was taken in this country, and that was back in the early 80s.
So this was a class action suit about ageism, right?
Just, of course, everybody that was let go was over 40. And Bob had been with the company for 20 years, and he was let go. And then, thank God, they did because I brought him right into the agency with me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we started. And together, we ran that agency for 23 years. And we did some wonderful stuff. We went all over the world. Minolta was one of my clients, and we used to do their President Club Awards, which were very much like an Academy Award. So it would be the Rookie of the Year, the Performer of the Year, you know, this, that.
Okay.
And we would do them in places like Hawaii, Switzerland, Bermuda. I did six shows on cruise ships where we would take over the entire ship. They charter the ship.
Yeah.
We, Sovereign of the Seas, the celebrity Sovereign of the Seas, Royal Caribbean Sovereign of the Seas. We had that ship, and we had Jerry Lewis and Al Martino.
Are we talking about the 60s here? The 70s?
We're talking the 80s.
The 80s?
In the 80s. Sovereigns of the Seas was, I think, around...
Oh, in the 80s. There was so much money.
85, 86. And Jerry Lewis was our headliner, and Al Martino was the singer.
Wow.
And we did fabulous, just wonderful things. So I wound up then introducing products. I wound up doing things for Nabisco, for Lifesavers. I did Mr. Peanut's 100th birthday party. And you know, you want to hear something interesting? We could not sing Happy Birthday.
Oh, I know. It's copywritten. That's what somebody got clever and copywrote it,
We couldn't sing Happy Birthday. And we had Mr. Peanut all in his regalia and everything like that. Down, and at that time, it was down in Winston-Salem because R.J. Reynolds had bought the Nabisco. So everything then had to be done out of R.J. Reynolds. I mean, we went all over this country, all over this world for our clients. We had Nabisco. We had Minolta. Eminem Mars was a wonderful client. I had a wonderful time with Eminem Mars. We took over the Playboy Club. They wanted to do a corporate show. And I wrote a fabulous show, and every employee was there, and we had to do three or four performances because there were so many to do. And I think the ballroom held like, the nightclub held like maybe 800. So we had to do like three or four performances so that everybody could come. So it was wonderful. So I did all those marching Eminem things, and it was great. Great. We had a wonderful time.
Okay, so now, this really sounds like a charmed life here.
I've always loved my work.
And it seems to have loved you back.
And it's been very good to me. And how I came to Florida was with Nabisco, they loved Disney World. So I did probably 8 or 9 shows at Disney World in the course of 2 or 3 years. I did about 8 or 9 shows down there. So I started to make connections down at Disney.
Right.
So the thing that had us get out of the business was now we're getting into the early 90s and an awful thing called PowerPoint came into being, and the world of technology came in. And you have to remember now, in those early years, in the 70s and 80s when we were doing all this stuff, we would do what they used to call multimedia, multi-image, which were basically like 30 or 40 projectors all timed, and things would go on and on. And they used to love to do live things. Then all of a sudden technology came into being, modern technology, and everybody now started doing PowerPoint in the office. They didn't need us anymore.
Right.
And our business just started to go right downhill because naturally, to do all this stuff, it was so much easier for them.
And cheaper.
And cheaper.
Ooh, yes, cheaper.
You know? I mean, I would do a sales meeting, and $1 million was nothing. They could do the same sales meeting a few years later for $100,000.
Oh, yeah.
They would save $900,000.
Right, and at the same time, money was beginning to get shorter.
So what wound up happening is we said, you know what? There's a time to enter and there's a time to exit.
While you're ahead.
And you know they talk about enter laughing.
Yes, right.
But you want to exit with a smile on your face. And so what we did, we sold the building, the business, all at the same time. And we exited out. We came down to Florida, which was a second residence we had down here. And that's another story on how we got to Florida. Can I digress? At the time, we were also very involved with community theater. In New Jersey.
Really?
At the Bergen County Players, which is probably the oldest community theater in the United States. They were in the Old Firehouse Theater, which was an old firehouse that was built in the early 1800s with the lookout steeple and everything like that. And a tremendous amount of stars. I mean, when I tell you the people that I worked with, Beth Fowler, who wound up being, you know, Mrs. Potts, Beauty and the Beast, and Boy from Oz, you know, Hugh Jackman's mother in the Boy from Oz, Robert Sean Leonard, who everybody knows. I had the little girl that became the second Annie. I had her in Sound of Music. I can't think of her name right now. And Philip Bosco. And I mean, I could go on and on and on the amount of people that were in that theater. And that I worked with, and then either they went on to Broadway or did other things. But I mean, Bobby Sean Leonard was a little 8-year-old kid in on Golden Pond, and then he wound up being the big star that he is today. Mm-hmm. So it was just wonderful. We were doing a play called I Do, I Do, And in I Do, there were something like 27 costume changes. And we had this couple, they were just terrific. And I don't know what happened, but after opening night, they decided they hated each other. And they would come, and it was such a stressful experience. My Bob was the stage manager. I was the director choreographer. And here we had to deal with these two people every night. They would have a kvetch no matter what it was about each other. She said, I've got many years disease now, and he cannot pick me up and whirl me around, so you have to restage this. And you name it, we had to do it. So we had a very dear friend, Ruth Ann Nathanson, who had a place on Holmes Beach. And when the show was over, she said, listen, we all need to go down to Florida. I have a place outside of Sarasota, and we just need to go down and have a couple of martinis and veg out. We said, you're on. And in those days, you didn't have to go and buy a ticket. You called up People's Airlines. You said, can I have a reservation? You showed up at the airport. You got on the plane, and they would come up and down the aisle with the little American Express machine, zip, zip, and you came down for $49.
Wow.
I mean, so that's how we came down here. And we just fell in love with this place. And the first time we drove from Holmes Beach, we drove through Longboat Key. She said, you'll never want to live here. It's too snobby. Look where we are. And then we went over the bridge, and we saw this purple shell. And I said, what's that? She said, that's the Van Wave Performing Arts Center. And I said, let's go check it out. And we pulled up, and who was appearing there that night but Pearl Bailey in concert. Now, you talk about, you know, coincidence, or you talk about its fate. I went up to the box office. I said, would you happen to have three tickets? They looked at me. They said, you have no idea how lucky you were. We have a single and two together. And I bought them.
Yeah.
And we went to the show, and of course, we drove back home, and we said, this is great. So we started coming down on our own. And it didn't take us long. We wound up on Lido, and we bought a place on Lido. So that's how we wound up having a second residence. So now I'll go back to Nabisco and all those years there, and then we decide we're going to sell the agency. And I said, you know, we ought to really think about living down in Florida, but let's check out what kind of theater they have.
Oh.
So don't I call up a couple of people from Disney, and I wind up coming down for an interview, and I had to make this major presentation to a board of 12 people, and I wind up getting hired as a part-time producer. And my first show was done so well, and I said to them, I've done producing. I mean, I ran an agency. I really like the creative. And they said, oh, okay, we need a show director for this. And I wound up directing 15 shows for Disney Business Entertainment. They have a business division in which the very kind of thing that I used to do for my clients, I was doing now for Disney. So then they said to me, I wound up talking with different people, and they said, gee, you know, you cast very well. How about being a casting director? And for 3 years, I wound up being a casting director and traveled all over for them. Bob and I, they'd fly us up to, in the summer, they would fly us up to New England. We'd start a Good Speed Opera in Connecticut, and we'd go all over the New England circuit, seeing a show at night, and auditioning the cast in the morning, because we'd get an opportunity to see what they look like on stage. And then that's what we were doing. And we would go out to the West Coast, and we would cast for Tokyo. We would cast for the cruise ships. So it was a great thing. So for 5 years, that's what we did when we moved down here. And then
it's just like one thing falls in your lap after another.
And I say this every day, Lynn, my phone never stops ringing. My phone never stops ringing. I've directed over 30 productions just locally, you know, between Manatee Players, Sarasota Players, and, you know, you were there.
Apple.
I just opened up at Golden Apple. After 12 years of being down here full-time, that's why I wrote in the program, I finally am directing at the Golden Apple, because we really became very close friends with the tour ops. And I had the best time and putting the show up in 10 days.
Oh, my God.
In 10 days.
And that's not an easy show.
No, it's not an easy show.
No, it's
show.
Really
and,
not.
And it doesn't stop, and it just keeps going.
No, and that set where they have to keep running up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And remember now, we only had that set for 48 hours.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
So 8 days, it's on the floor, and I keep saying, remember, you've got a step there. Remember, that's a platform. Remember, that's an escape.
Right.
So, you know, we had to worry about them, you know,
not falling off.
Themselves.
Right. Yeah.
And because once they get on it, you know, like any set, steps are not like the normal steps. They're not like you go out
Right.
And walk down your flight of stairs.
Right.
Everything is shallow, and you know, because it has to fit.
Right.
So, you know, you have to worry about them falling and tripping, and so they have to literally go down the stairs sideways, and you don't realize that when you see it. But they're not going up those stairs face forward.
Well, and you know, what I first am thinking is walking stairs is such a involuntary, unconscious, I mean, it's amazing that they keep, that they know, that they remember every time they put their foot on a step that mm-hmm. they have to do, while they're singing.
Yeah, and know, sometimes in the dark. Sometimes they're going through a transition and they have to know where they are.
Right.
So, so getting back to all the shows down here, after 5 years at Disney, and I loved every single moment of it, it just got to be too much of, here we live in this beautiful place on the Gulf of Mexico. We would go up there on a Sunday night. We would work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We'd drive back Friday night, do the laundry on Saturday, get all the mail, do all the bills, and be back up there for Sunday night to start on Monday morning.
So you didn't live in Orlando?
Yeah, we lived at the Marriott Residence Inn, and we had an apartment.
Oh, but you...
We didn't live there. We had... We lived on property. We lived on Disney property.
But then, are you saying, when you said you went home, where did you go home to?
Here. Come back here.
Right. So you lived, you lived in Sarasota, but you
worked.
Hung out in Orlando.
We worked up there.
But you didn't choose to live in Orlando.
No, because it's a transient city.
Yeah, well, you know, you actually don't have to explain. I mean, if it were me, I wouldn't live in Orlando, and I would live right here.
Yeah, that's right. And then we'd come home here. We'd sit out on this balcony that we're looking at.
And say to yourself,
and
my God.
What are we doing? So I transferred, as I say. I moved out of Disney, and I started to work for Busch Gardens, which was a little bit more local. And I directed and put together Rhino Rally, which was the big $44 million event that they had up there. And then Castaway Critters and a few other things. So, and I'm still doing consulting work for Busch Gardens, and they're wonderful people. They're just, that's a real family up there, too. Real family. I mean, there are people up there that started picking up garbage in the parks and now work in the executive offices. I mean, people that were pumping beer, because at the time they used to have the beer pavilion, and are now executives. I mean, they took care of their own. People got promoted from within. And I love them, and I still do. And they're very kind to me. Anytime I do any kind of a charity event down here, the Busch Gardens people will say, how many tickets do you want, you know, to raffle off and stuff like that. So I've done really good. Yeah, and then here, you know, between Manatee Players, Sarasota Players, Golden Apple, I've worked it all, you know, so it's good.
My God,
life is good.
Well, it's. I mean, I am so struck by the way things fell for you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, you and this is not to, I don't know how to say this. It's so clear that you, from day one or from year five, you know, that this is what you were meant to do.
Yeah,
and that it was natural to you that it was yours to do.
I always use the expression, I followed my dream.
And you
know? But I also knew that, you know, you're never going to make a living, a real living, in the theater. Few do.
Right.
You know?
Few do. Right.
The average, I remember this years ago, I was always amazed. The average salary of an equity actor in the United States, and it's changed now, but at one time, the average salary for an equity actor was $5,000 a year.
Yeah.
That took in those that made $1 million and those that made 50 cents a week.
Or nothing.
Right. Because what I did for love from Chorus Line is so true.
That's
People did not make a living. You know, they always had to do something else.
Right.
And I thought, you know, I can always do theater, but, you know, I want to live a comfortable life. I don't mind working hard, but I like to play hard too, so I want to be able to afford to play hard. So I've been lucky. I was always able to take the theater and bring it into the corporate world.
Yes, you did. You melded your not only your worlds, but your skills.
I still get calls. I still do work up in Orlando. I still get calls for to work. There's two agencies up in Orlando that call me. They have Siemens, you know, the wonderful medical company from Germany, and Liz Claiborne. Somewhat retired, as we would say back here. I did four or five shows for Liz Claiborne and introduced all her perfume lines. Mambo and Bora Bora and Curve and Lucky. I did all those.
Wow.
So that was good. And I would go out to Las Vegas, or we would go out to the West Coast, or we would do them in Disney and do big shows all on...
And so I'm still struck by this. I mean, you're essentially still doing what Pat had you do at five.
Oh, yeah. I'm still working. I mean...
But, I mean, you're doing... It's so interesting. I mean, it's the ability to design something for the audience. Mm-hmm. You and Pat and your brother were designing something for your parents.
And aunts and uncles.
And aunts and uncles,
yeah.
Right. And so you learned how to take what people want or need or interests them or whatever and turn that into an entertainment.
Yep.
That's a remarkable skill.
Yeah, well, that you learn, and those are things you learn young. You know, children that, you know, take music lessons early and, you know,
that's
get
right.
into the arts, boy, you know, you can just see it in their life, how they live their life, too.
That's right, that's
you know?
Right.
Yeah, no, the arts, definitely. Without the arts, I would never have the appreciation or the success that I have today. Yeah.
Well, and you wouldn't, I mean, and all of those people wouldn't have benefited from you.
Well, that's nice to hear.
Well, I mean, it's obviously clear, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, because, as you say, the phone keeps ringing. So
it's
what you do.
And, you know, I love what I do because I love to teach, you know, and being a director, being a choreographer, being a creative consultant, you are partly teaching, you know. And I love to work with young people.
I've done Sound of Music with lots of kids. I've done Oliver. I've done Seussical twice. And of all the big kid shows, the one I really never did was Annie, although I've seen it 100 times. And the fun thing with this show is we had 120 kids come out and audition.
Oh, my God.
So there are only 6 orphans in Annie. And so what we wound up doing is giving each one an understudy and allowing the understudies now to go on when we do the extension. So
really?
Each kid will be on stage at all times. So and then also get a chance to do the role that they're understudying. But the understudies are going to be on with the regulars. So instead of having 7 orphans on stage, it'll be 14. So it makes the production numbers bigger, stronger.
Yeah. But I'm thinking 120 kids?
Auditioned.
That must have been so difficult.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll tell you, the difficult part about doing the show is that of these 120 kids, I would say 99%, if not 100%, are all professionally trained. They all take dance class, singing lessons, acting lessons. So you get these kids that when they hit the stage, they're all like electric.
Yeah, right.
And everything lights up. And then they're followed by community theater people that a lot of them did not have some training like that. And it's really, you know, hard because it's like, you know, being a singer and following Bocelli on stage.
Oh, no,
you know?
Yeah, but and... It, you need to make a balance. I mean,
exactly.
That's up to you, isn't it?
Yeah,
to make
so
it,
the show
so that
has
it's not
to. Right, because you come off one Bafo production number after another with
the kids.
And then you're going into a production number with adults. So you got to make them just as exciting as the kids because the kids have the energy and the age and the training.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a challenge.
That's a challenge for the director.
That was a big challenge.
Yeah.
Big challenge.
Yeah.
So hopefully we did
it. Did you know?
Did I know that I was going to get professionally trained kids?
Yeah.
I kind of figured I would because this city, you know, all the kids go everywhere. You know, they go to school after school after school. You know what I mean?
I didn't realize there were that many kids in this town that are trying to be professional.
Yep. Well, you know, you've got spotlight kids, players kids, kids going to private dance class and vocal.
Wow.
And, you know, all
so the, was it difficult to choose then?
Yes, very. Yeah, very. Because I could have probably cast 50 kids of the 120 without a problem.
Oh.
And, you know, we wound up casting 14. So as you can imagine on the callbacks, there was a lot of crying.
A lot of crying.
Because there was like 50 kids here for the callbacks. So, I mean, it was kind of hard.
And I'm thinking, you know, you love to work with kids, so you must not like to disappoint them.
Well, that's it. You know, I mean, each one of them, you know, you kind of somewhat adopt them as they, you know, grow on you. You know,
because
you get to know, you know, become a family.
Had any of these kids done it before?
Yes. As a matter of fact, some of the kids even played Annie before, so you can imagine the disappointment.
Oh, God. So you had several kids who had played Annie,
mm-hmm.
who come to audition for
mm-hmm.
Annie,
mm-hmm.
who think they have a really good shot at it because they've already played it,
mm-hmm.
and some of them you had to say no to.
That's right.
Oy, oy, oy.
And you go, it's also a matchup. You know, it's
right.
You can't have, you know, 6 blondes or, you know, you can't.
Right.
You know,
right.
You've got to, and you have, each personality in the play is totally different. There's Peppa, who's the toughie,
mm-hmm.
and there's Tessie, who's the crybaby, and, you know, and then there's Molly, who is the little, you know, curmudgeon, mm-hmm. and she's the youngest, and so you have to have each of those types. So mm-hmm. it's not like you've got six or seven little girls.
No,
you have
right,
six
right,
or
right.
seven different characters.
Right, right.
So that's a challenge.
I think it is. I think it is, and I think it's. I was smart of them to hire you to do it because well, because you have so much experience working with kids.
Yeah, I've done a lot with children
no
over the
kidding,
years.
No
but,
kidding.
But you know, it's more work naturally mm-hmm. because you know you have all that extra challenges to overcome. But it was worth it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you're opening on
the 6th.
On the 6th.
And then we go right through till the 23rd of December.
Wow.
So practically right up to Christmas Eve.
Yeah. That's a long run for
yeah,
this
it's
year.
A long run. It's right. a long run. Right. But it's doing well. So tickets are going like crazy.
Ah, oh, it's wonderful.
You know?
It's wonderful.
Plus, you got to remember, 120 some odd kids came out.
Oh, that's
so
right.
They're going to all want to see what they missed.
Right, right, right. You know. And they're going to want to see how they could have done it better.
Whatever.
So, what's next for you, Bobby? Do you
right
know?
From there, I go into rehearsals for A Funny Thing Happened the Way to the Forum.
Where?
Up at Manatee.
Really?
Yeah, it's the last show in the old theater before the Wrecking Ball. So they've extended that already. That's going to
when does that up. Open? Do you remember?
It opens up February 21st, and it runs right through till the 18th, I think, of March.
The last question I ask, just to think for a second about what it's been like to spend an entire life really submerged mm-hmm. in what I don't even know what to call it, the art of bringing entertainment to people, to creating entertainment for people, to using the essentially the stuff you came in with,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to have done that for an entire life,
mm-hmm.
you know, is there anything that comes to mind that you'd want to say about it?
Yeah, two things. In the corporate world, my job was to motivate and educate.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I would get hired year after year from the same corporation was sort of the honor that was given to me, because to motivate a sales force and to educate the marketing and sales people to go out and do a better job, and they do, and they reach their numbers and their quotas, and the company made a profit, that's when they would ask us to come back. So knowing that either if I wrote the script or if I coached the executive in his speech to have passion, or if we did motivate the sales force to say, hey, let's go out and do that and make it happen, that was my payback. More than the money with the payback was that they would take me back year after year because I did my job.
Yes.
That was good. The second thing I think also is some of the most interesting people that I've worked with that I never expected to be so surprised. And one was Sammy Davis Jr. I was working with a group called Group 5, which were five jingle singers that met in studios and decided to put a group together. And they were very famous people. You wouldn't know them by name, but you would know them by, I love New York. You would know them by, meow, 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 and McDonald's. These were people that did these jingles. And they put together this wonderful act, and they would sing all their jingles, and then they would sing other songs. And they were picked up by Sammy Davis Jr. And I had been working with them, choreographing them, and he was making his comeback at Bally's in Atlantic City. And they said, would you come down and help us? Because not only do we want you to stage your number, but Sammy said, that was always what he used to say, Sammy said, that he wanted to bridge their number into his entrance. Mm-hmm. And would you do it? And I said, well, of course. So I went down, and I was a little apprehensive, you know, the Rat Pack and the Frank Sinatra world and all this kind of stuff. And he was, at that time, a kingpin. You know, he was way up there. And I was nervous about it. And I wound
up... Even though you were a New Jersey boy?
Yeah. And yeah. And so here I put this thing together, and it was this one particular section of the show. There was... I wanted to have five different pin spots on each of the five singers, and the stage manager said to me, I only have three, and that's what you'll have to live with. And I said, okay, and I didn't want to make waves, so I did. And then I met Mr. Davis, and he said to me, how come that they're not in their own individual light? I said, well, to be honest, the stage manager said that's all the equipment he has. He said, you go back and tell him Sammy said. That's what I said. And, of course, the next night I had the five spotlights.
Right.
But what he did, what was so gracious of him, we had our opening night, and he had his rhythm section, his mother, his sister, the act, Bob and I, and he had a five-star gourmet restaurant opened at 1 a.m. in the morning, had us all there, and he said, whatever you want, and he sat with us, and just, we had surf and turf and the best champagne and wine, and he was just so gracious, and he was just the opposite. I thought he was going to be this big diva, or divo, and he wasn't. He was probably, and he was so informative and just, you know, chatted about how he started in the business. And
he was a mensch. He was a human being.
He was such a human being, and he was so wonderful. And I think we chatted till the sun came up, and it was just a beautiful experience. And I, you know, really loved working with him. It was
great.
Well,
but you've had really the cream, haven't you?
Oh, I know I did.
Yeah, you have. It's
life's been good.
Life's been good.
Yeah.
And not only has it been good, but it's going to continue to be good.
I feel that way.
Yeah, there's no question about it.
I'm not stopping.
No. And we're very grateful.
Oh, I'm grateful. Believe me, I am. Yeah.
It's a good place to stop.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bobby.
So, there you have it. Bob Tricolini, who started his entertaining career by standing on his head and falling over. And in a way, he's still doing it. He is still standing on his head to entertain us. Everything that he does is about bringing joy and pleasure and energy and passion. You can hear it in the tone of his voice, in the rapid way that he speaks. You can hear it in the energy that's just coming off this guy. And it's all about helping other people by entertaining. And in this, of course, Bob Tricolini demonstrates what I'm trying to do with The Lynn Show. He is 100% who he is. He's not second-guessing himself. He's not asking himself, should he be something else, do something else. He is himself. And that is what comes across. And, of course, that is what's so compelling about all of the work that he does, whether he's on stage or behind stage or have written the script for the stage. Because this was a long interview, and I didn't want to cut any more than I had to. I'm absolutely running out of time, and I really want to play another song from Annie before I close. So it's time to say that if you want to hear this interview again or any of the podcasts of any of the shows that I've done over the last 3 years, if you want to find my book, When You Can, You Will, you want to buy the book, you want to find out about psychotherapy on the phone or call me or ask me a question, then you want to go up to the website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. You have to do thelynnshow.com, otherwise you may get a different Lynn. And if you want to get a hold of Josh Hackney, who, as I say at the end of every show, is the reason that this show still exists, because he can find the software, he can teach me how to use it, he can reteach me how to use it when I've forgotten, he can fix it, he can build the computer. So if you want Josh for any of those things, you can also get him at thelynnshow.com. And I'm going to try and go out on another song from Annie. This is Easy Street, a song that the bad guys sing, and it swings, and I kind of like it, so we're going to go out on it. But as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that you can use. Even if it's just, as it was for me, completely entertaining to listen to Bob. But maybe there was some inspiration in it, too, for you. To not to do what others say you should, or what others would do in your place, but to do you. As always, I hope that whatever you heard will bring you back, because I will be back next week. Same time, same station. And I sure hope you will be, too.
I remember the way our sainted mother would sit and croon us our lullaby.
She'd say, kids, there's a place that's like no other. You gotta get there before you die.
You don't get there by playing from the rule book.
You stack the aces.
You load the dice.
Mother dear, oh, we know you're down there listening.
How can we follow your sweet advice to
Easy Street? Easy Street, where you sleep till noon.
Yeah.
She'd repeat.
Sis, who was the hot tomato in the fancy car?
Personal secretary to Oliver Warbucks.
The Oliver Warbucks? The millionaire?
No, the billionaire, you dumb hotel. Lives up on Fifth Avenue.
Hey, Warbucks don't live on Fifth Avenue.
He don't? Where does he live?
Easy Street. Easy Street.
What did the secretary want?
Tommy Warbucks is going to adopt Annie, this rotten orphan I despise. Now the lousy kid's going to have everything.
It ain't fair.
I know, it ain't fair.
It ain't fair how we scrounge for $3 or $4 while she gets Warbucks.
The little brat. It ain't fair. This here life is driving me nuts. While we get peanuts, she's living fat.
Maybe she holds the key, this little lady,
to getting more bucks
instead of less.
Maybe we fix the game with something shady.
Where would that put us?
Tell her.
Give you one guess.
Yes! Easy Street.
I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face and figure I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime.